For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem of human life was how to conform the soul to objective reality, and the solution was wisdom, self-discipline, and virtue. For the modern, the cardinal problem is how to conform reality to the wishes of man, and the solution is technique. This is Pints with Jack, Season 7, Episode 29, Narnia Month, Not a Tame Lion. After Hours with Dr. Terry Gillespie. Welcome, everyone, here on Pints with Jack. We're recording our way through the works of C.S. Lewis. But today, we're in one of our themed months, specifically Narnia Month. And now that we've finished the Chronicles, we're interviewing some more scholars. And today, I am speaking with Dr. Terry Gillespie. He has a master's degree in history from the University of Oregon and a doctorate in spiritual formation from Northwind Seminary, where he now teaches Inkling Studies, Spiritual Formation, and Writing. He is listed in Who's Who in America and has been the recipient of a number of awards, including a Distinguished Alumni Award and the Advanced Speakers and Writers Editor of the Year Award. He has written over a dozen books, including Discovering God Through the Arts, The Prayers by Jane Austen, and the book we'll be discussing today, Not a Tame Lion, The Life, Teachings, and Legacy of C.S. Lewis. He has two books, Book of the Year awards from Christianity Today, as well as Book of the Year awards from Gospel Coalition and the Evangelical Christian Publishers Association. His most acclaimed book, so maybe you guys should check it out, is 75 Masterpieces Every Christian Should Know. Terry, welcome to Pints with Jack.
It is a pleasure and an honor to be with you. Place where all good Lewis lovers get to hang out and talk about all things.
I got to say, too, I was excited for this because your title of this book, funnily enough, so I'm getting married in a few months, so I'm engaged.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. My now fiance, after our second date, I think it was. So she's getting to know me a little bit here. And she knew that I had done a Pints with Jack thing and had a love for Lewis. And so she put in her messages, Matt, not a tame lion, Bush. Just out of pure coincidence, I didn't know this for like a month or two. It was more because she just realized as she got to know me early on that I guess I kind of beat to my own drum a little bit and will not be tameable in any way, shape, or form. And so she ended up getting me for Christmas a gold lion statue, like off of the Narnia series that she had made, and it's super beautiful. So when I saw this, I was like, all right, this is God's way of saying I got to interview Dr. Terry Gillespie.
Awesome.
So I'm excited for this. Anyways, while we jump in here, we usually have a drink where we're enjoying a beverage as we do these conversations. Unfortunately, I am Pacific time, so this is more around lunchtime, and I have some stuff this afternoon. So I just have water, but are you drinking anything?
Well, water for me too. That's my that's my drink of choice at this time of the day.
Well, we are in good company then. Well, beautiful. Well, let's dive right in. And before getting into the book, getting into some of the material in it, what was the motivation and inspiration behind it, let's start out with a bit about yourself and your relationship with Lewis. So I gave a little bit of a highlight reel of your background, but if you want to fill in any of the blanks there, and then also just what got you to fall in love with Lewis and your passion for him.
Well, okay, let's just go right to that. I was in Bible college, had just started Bible college. For a lot of people who've been to Bible college, they might know that in some ways it could be one of the most challenging places to go in terms of your faith. Mm. It's like everything is just kind of assumed. And I'm a person who asks a lot of questions, and I was finding that Bible college was not doing what I thought it would. It was not giving me many answers to my questions. And in fact, my faith was actually seeming less real to me. And so during this time of challenge, someone I know said, hey, have you ever tried reading C.S. Lewis? Well, that had been on my list of books that I should probably try to read at some point. So they recommended Mere Christianity. Mm. And so I picked it up and I started reading it on my lunch hours. Instead of doing my homework, I would knock off a couple chapters of Mere Christianity. And it sounds like such a tired old cliche to say a book changed your life. But I'm going to say that that book did change my life. It wasn't even so much that Lewis came flying in on the white horse to answer every question and get rid of all my doubts or anything like that. Although it did help that he did was honest, realistic. He put a lot of emphasis on thinking about things clearly. He wanted our faith to be reasonable. But more than that, even, I think it was, for the first time as I read Mere Christianity, I not only got some answers, but I had a vision. I got a vision for what the Christian life should be, what walking with Jesus really could mean, and how it could change the way I thought about the world, the way I saw the world, and the way I lived in the world. And immediately after finishing that book, I picked up The Great Divorce. I read it literally in one sitting. I kind of sat down on the couch and ended up laying down on the couch before I had finally finished reading it through all in one sitting. And from that time on, I just began to explore C.S. Lewis's books and probably read more C.S. Lewis books during that next couple years in Bible college than I did required textbooks. I did manage to graduate anyway. And I think actually the Lewis books helped me in some ways because they gave me some clarity of thought as well as moved my heart and moved my soul. And so at the time, I've just been a huge Lewis fan. I've written several books. I felt like I wanted to pay a debt to Lewis by introducing Lewis to some to other people. And so what I wanted to do was write a very easy to read, approachable introduction to Lewis's life and thought.
I was actually thinking that when I went through it. This is incredible of how accessible it is, which is very Lewisian in the sense that he makes a bunch of everything he read in his life accessible for people and some higher theological concepts. I also loved how a person could, not to jump ahead to diving into your book quite yet, but I love how a person could go through and pick almost like index some of, at least the second part, particularly some of the specific chapters. All right, what did Lewis write about heaven and hell? What did he write about Satan and the devil? You can get a nice high overview, but then obviously you bring in some of his direct references, direct quotes from the book. So then you could actually go to the book if you really wanted to. So really a wonderful resource, which is what we'll jump to in a little bit later in this conversation, is some of those specific sections and some of those specific topics. And so I love that.
Thank you for saying that. I mean, that was really my intention. I mean, the thing about the book is the chapters are purposefully short. I think there are 30 chapters that cover his life and 30 chapters that cover his thought and some of his key themes. And so, you know, I wanted it almost like something people could read just a chapter a day and think about it. And I mean, my biggest goal in the book is if someone reads this book and it makes them excited enough about Lewis that they start reading Lewis's own books, then I have achieved my goal.
Mm.
Because they're going to get so much more out of reading the full meal deal of Lewis than they are through reading my little book, which hopefully is just kind of an invitation to say, hey, here's somebody that's worth exploring. Here's somebody who might change your heart and mind the way he did mine.
I love that. Well, before we get into the book itself, so a couple quick questions. One's a small one, because you know Andrew, correct?
Yes, I do. Uh-huh. Very well.
And you said you read The Great Divorce in one setting. So maybe you can help chime in on the debate of whether The Great Divorce or Till We Have Faces is Lewis's best book.
Oh, my goodness.
You probably know where Andrew lands.
I know absolutely where Andrew lands. It's all about the faces for... For Andrew, you know, I would say that I would not argue with the idea that Till We Have Faces is Lewis's greatest literary achievement. I mean, the level of characterization, the quality of the writing is really, I mean, it is Lewis at his peak. But I think The Great Divorce, kind of along with The Chronicles of Narnia, is the peak of Lewis as the spiritual writer. And maybe, you know, those are his greatest spiritual works, where he unfolds such a powerful vision of what faith looks like in practice and what it feels like, it by creating these kind of the simple, playful mythology. It just gives us this whole new series of insights. So, yeah. So I cheated and gave a both and answer.
That's all right. One final question before diving into the book. From your perspective, I always love to just kind of get scholars, different perspectives, because you've read a lot on Lewis. Obviously, you've written some books, materials about him. What would you say kind of really separates Lewis from other wonderful Christian scholars and authors and made him so wildly popular?
Yeah, that's a great question. And my answer to that, because that's something I've thought about a little bit, is that Lewis combines three elements in a way that no other author, I think, does. So they are reason, imagination, and an evocation of the sense of the holy. So Lewis, in his writings, does such an effective job of appealing to our rationality, to our common sense. He puts one and one and one more together in such a way that we begin to understand things clearly. He shows that faith really makes sense of, not intellectually only, but of our lives and of our experiences. He demonstrates that Christianity is not an escape from reason, but is actually a rational and a reasonable faith. It makes sense. But yet he does that in such a way that there's a humility to it that I love, you know? It never feels with Lewis like he's trying to offer proof that's just like inarguable proof, but he's actually just pointing to the fact that this way of living, this way of thinking, this way of experiencing our lives, this makes sense. This makes sense of everything. So it's rational. It's reasonable. It's a larger picture of reason. So that's one, is reason. The second, of course, is imagination. I mean, Lewis, one of the things we love about Lewis is how he appeals to not only our mind, but also to our heart and our emotions through his creative writing. And he's so imaginative in the way that he uses stories and images and mythology that show truth in action, that give feet to it, that kind of embody it. For Lewis, it's never just a theological abstraction, right? That truth and the imagination are not at odds, that the imagination is just another way, like reason is, of talking about reality and what is. And then the third, and I think in some ways he picks up a lot from his great mentor, George MacDonald, in this, is that he evokes that sense of the holy, that sense of a sacred reality that exists alongside our ordinary, everyday, day-to-day existence, that by using these unforgettable, like, images of God, these pictures of, like, for example, Aslan, unforgettable picture of who Christ is and how Christ operates. It's a way that the God who is so big and who is wholly other is brought near to us through this imagery, and we sense that holiness. I mean, I think You know, I don't think I'd be going too far to say that really in almost every C.S. Lewis book, you can sense the presence of God in and through his writing, that he is experiencing God. And through his books, you are given the opportunity to experience God, not just think about God, but actually to experience God's presence and reality in a way maybe you never have before. I just think there's no other author that makes the supernatural so convincingly real. That whole realm becomes real to us. So, you know, and there are other authors who take one or two of those things. I mean, there are great thinkers, you know, who can make great arguments for the faith or build these magnificent structures of theology with their fine architecture of ideas. There are those who can tell great stories and excite our imagination. And then there are those who can give us that sense of God's holiness. But nobody that I can think of brings all three together as well as C.S. Lewis does, so effectively.
I love that answer because particularly that third point I don't hear stressed enough. And so I'm really glad you brought that in. I think I read a book by someone actually from my hometown, Holland, Michigan, Professor Hope College, that I want to say wrote a book called Reasoned in Imagination about Lewis, but I'd never heard that third point really tying it all together because it is, it's one thing to have one of those, another thing to have another one, another to have both of them, but bringing this third dynamic in it. As you were stating that, I was really thinking to myself, wow, he really does do that really well. That is really how I experience it.
And I think that that's why Lewis is not just your typical kind of Christian apologist making arguments for faith. He has a whole kind of different way of doing apologetics in a certain sense that's bigger and broader. And it's what I think really draws us to him.
Yes. So well said. Well, let's turn to your book now. And as you've already alluded to beforehand, the structure of your book for listeners, he has two parts in the book, the part on Lewis's life and the part on his theology, more or less. And really broke it down into 30 chapters in each in keeping it quite direct to the point and concise. So I want to spend more time on the second part, but before jumping there, the first part, which is more on Lewis's life, is there any takeaway you would love for the listeners that could be helpful for just understanding Lewis? Rather than going too deep in this conversation, I'll probably link some other conversations we have had for listeners from a while back where we've kind of dove into his life a little bit in the past. But from your perspective, from your reading, was there some parts that are like, you know what, this is kind of important to understand about Lewis and has really driven his theology, the way he thinks, the way he operates, his worldview, anything like that?
Well, someone once said, and I can't remember exactly who it was, but someone once said, all theology is autobiography.
Mm.
There's a lot of truth to that, that our theology does, what makes our theology strong and unique and our way of expressing our faith strong and unique are the set of experiences that we've had with, in this case, with, you know, Lewis's experiences with God. His, you know, probably greatest addition to the argument of apologetics, you might say, is his argument from desire, that argument from longing, that the fact that we have these longings that we can't really fully explain, but they draw us and they point us towards something beyond just that desire. And so, you know, for Lewis, that starts even as a child. And so what became one of his key arguments is actually birthed in his biography. That's how he came to faith. I mean, I think a lot of people who don't, you know, or are new to Lewis would think, well, the way C.S. Lewis came to faith was probably that he did a lot of careful study of all the great world philosophies and compared them and contrasted them. And he thought through all of the rational arguments until he finally arrived at the decision that Christianity was the truest and best religion, best way of looking at God. Well, that's actually Not true. That's maybe a secondary process, but what actually first leads him toward God are these experiences that he has. I call it intuitional apologetics. You know, he's very effective at that kind of reason-based argument and using creativity, but he also engages in this third way, which I think of as intuitional apologetics. And that's a method of connecting common human experiences or really heightened experiences we might have, such as longing, such as our experience of something that's just so beautiful that it takes our breath away, or maybe that awakening of love, the first stirrings of human love. What Lewis does is he shows us how they point toward the spiritual realities that underlie our own lives. And so these are the kinds of experiences that open the heart and they open the mind to consider truths which actually transcend those experiences. They just point toward something more. And so I think that Lewis, throughout his life, that's something he did well. When he ran across George MacDonald's book while he was still not a believer, his book, Fantasties, he read it. And what did it say that he did? It baptized his imagination. Well, what does that mean? It baptized his imagination. Well, it didn't make him a Christian because, as he says in Surprised by Joy, it was just the first step on a process by which eventually led to his faith. But what it did is it began to reorient the way that he saw his life. It opened him up to spiritual possibilities as he glimpsed through this fantasy, this world which was beautiful and mysterious and dangerous and yet innocent, all these things. He says in one place that that book helped him get that first sense of the holy. Well, I think that's what began that process of bringing him to faith. You know, if you ask people, how did you become a Christian? Almost nobody's answer is, well, I lost an argument.
I've never thought of that, but you're right.
Right? You know, it's actually things that happen before you get to that place of getting to where you want to believe, you're ready to believe, then you're ready to hear the arguments. And there's a really valid place for it. But there's all this preparatory work, this kind of pre-evangelism that Lewis's books do. And I think that's a reflection of his long and winding path toward faith. You know, when he first knelt down to accept that God was real, it was still a couple years before he actually saw that Christ was who he said he was. You know, it was a process.
I love that. I've never really thought about that. No, you are right. No one has ever said I lost an argument. And I really like how you phrased it as getting them to want to.
Pascal, who of course was, you know, one of the great apologists, he said that the task of apologetics is to make faith attractive, to make good men wish that it were true, and then show that it is. To make it attractive.
So good.
Make good men wish it were true, and then show that it is. And Lewis, better than almost anybody else, does that. Because he's such a clear thinker, but he also brings these experiences from his own life to bear.
You're blowing my mind right now. We can probably just end this conversation here. No.
I should probably do what George Costanza did in that one episode of Seinfeld, where it's like he said something really smart, and so he learned that he should just throw up his hands and leave the room before he said
in the moment. I'm going to try to watch that one tonight. I'm at my friends here in San Diego, and I have not seen most Seinfeld, but they love to watch an episode sometimes in the evenings. And so when I'm here, we'll sometimes watch them. So I'm going to actually try to find that one. Well, beautiful. Well, let's, on that note, let's dive into some of the theology. Let's make this look beautiful and attractive, because I do believe Lewis does that well, and you did that well channeling that. As Terry's already mentioned, every chapter is a concise chapter on a different theme. And I really would recommend doing it like a Screwtape Letters, where maybe you decide to read a chapter a morning as part of a devotional. They're 3 pages, 4 pages, 5 pages. I think, like, I don't want to say max 6, but you know, that's on the higher side for some of them. It's just really wonderful. You learn just about all these topics of Lewis, from virtue to morality to heaven to hell to Christ, and just, you know, the endless different topics. So really wonderful, kind of as a devotional almost. Let's start with Jesus. I really wanted to start on that chapter. Seemed like a fitting one. And particularly just what Lewis writes about Christ, because in today's day and age, it seems like there is a very strong desire to take him as a great moral teacher. And it sounds like from Lewis, that was probably desire back then too. I have literal friends that I can think about that would never like surrender their life or call him a Lord and Savior, but they're like, oh, you know, I like to read some of his stuff. It's really good from a philosophical perspective or from treating people correctly. And obviously, as we know, it's like, that's not what we're supposed to do. So let's start there. Lewis's thought on Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think what's powerful is that he is able to make us think about that whole question of, okay, what would it mean to be a great teacher? Because as you said, there are very few people who would say, well, you know, that stuff Jesus said, that's kind of nonsense. Well, almost everybody would say, you know, well, Jesus was at least a great teacher. But as Lewis says, and of course, you know, to be fair about this argument, he's depending upon the fact that the scriptural text that we have about the words of Jesus are accurate. But if we can make that assumption, which I think is a very, very safe assumption, then what did this great teacher say? Well, among other things, he claimed to be able to forgive sins. A human,
no big deal.
You know, it's like, okay, if you do something that offends me, I can certainly say, I forgive you. But if you do something that offends Andrew Lazo, and I
all
say,
the time,
I forgive you, I, Terry, forgive you for that, that would seem a little bit presumptive, you know,
yep.
Because only God can forgive sins. And so what Lewis is trying to say is that if Jesus was only a good teacher, then why did he say some of the things that he did that were so striking, that were so potentially offensive to the people of his time and perhaps to our time? Why did he make the claim to be God? Who makes the claim to be God? The only people, Lewis says, that make the claim to be God or someone who's a liar, someone who's a lunatic, who is, I think Lewis's phrase is, who has the intellect of a poached egg, or someone who actually is who he claims to be. Is he a liar? Is he a lunatic? Or is he Lord? And he says, we're not given the opportunity to say, well, he's merely a good teacher. Mm. Because he claimed to be something more. And the life that he lived showed him to be something more. And that Lewis himself had found him to be somebody more than that. So yeah, it's a good starting place to say Jesus is a good teacher, but let's see what he really taught. And let's ask the question, could any mere human being have had this kind of insight into the human experience? You'd have to be both fully God and fully human, which is what Orthodox Christianity says that Jesus Christ was.
Mm, I love that. Let's turn to your section on pain. And particularly, I want to highlight a couple quotes and then just let you kind of chime in here a little bit. Because we just finished the Latin letters and Letters to American Lady and Letters to Children. Those were the three that we did. And it just, pain stuck out to me, particularly the offering it up and suffering. And so I really love these two quotes that you put in here that just, more or less, I'm just selfishly putting this in here because I want listeners, pretty much all of these I'm putting in here because I just want listeners to hear this knowledge. So this one, Lewis believed that we can, in a very real sense, participate in the sufferings of Christ by embracing our pains and difficulties for his sake, which was a theme that really stuck out to me in some of his letters. And then secondly, sometimes we cannot be trusted with lives of pleasure and security. For when we possess these, we so quickly forget the giver of all good things and trust in the gifts instead. That was so powerful. Forget the giver and trust the gifts. I mean, that just, that's like a nice quote, by the way, just in general.
Don't say that. I say that one. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure you did.
Yeah. Okay. Usually if something's that good, it's him, it's not me, but okay. That was my way of encapsulating his thought. I mean, I think what's important about Lewis's view of pain is his view of what Jesus wants to do to human beings. The plan that God set out to accomplish in Christ was not merely just to provide hell insurance to keep us from eternal damnation. Mm-hmm. It was not purely to move us from the category of the lost to the category of the saved. That's part of what salvation is about. But Lewis had a much bigger view, and that was the view that what the Christian life is about is it's a life of transformation. It's the fact that God wants to take who we are now and make us into something more beautiful than we can even imagine. That's his eternal goal for us. And what Lewis recognized, and Lewis wasn't alone in this, most of the great spiritual writers throughout history have talked about the fact that, pain and suffering, it's not something we should masochistically try to go out and look for. We don't need to grab a whip and flagellate ourselves if we want to grow in faith. I don't think that's the goal. But the goal is this, that the reality of the human life is that it's going to be filled with pain and hardship. It just is. That's the ugly truth. And the other truth is that if we live lives without any pain or without much pain, we usually end up being completely self-centered and just become overwhelmed in a negative way by all the pleasures of life. But what he wants to do is he wants to transform us, and that pain, as Lewis said, pain is his megaphone to rouse a sleeping world. There was a little scrap of a poem. This is not by Lewis, but I think he would agree with this view. Someone wrote, "I walked a mile with pleasure and she chattered all the way, but she left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with suffering and she was silent all the way, but oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow came my way." I think I botched that a little bit, but the concept there is that our pain not just teaches us ideas, but it transforms us. We're like a lump of clay that in order to be really molded into something beautiful, it has to go through that process of pressure being applied. And the pain and suffering of life applies the pleasure that's transformative for us, if we will allow God to transform us in that way.
Mm. Well, that's a perfect transition to one I was going to jump on a little bit later, but I'm going to do it now, on morality and virtue, because I really love how you phrase in the pain. Everything is about turning us in ontologically becoming the type of person that like desires heaven. And this really connects with the virtue part. And I'm going to similarly read off some quotes, mainly just because I think they're brilliant again, and I want people to hear them. But you talk about in here how there was this one part where you're like, if you're doing them for the wrong reasons, let's pretend you actually live an incredibly virtuous life, but it's completely for the wrong reasons. So you're not actually getting the transformation of heart on the inside. You're missing the point. I got to be careful saying you're not going to go to heaven off of that. It's not my place to say whether you are or not. But point being is like, you're not becoming the type of person that these are meant to be. They're not just an arbitrary set of rules for the sake of obedience. There's so much more. And so let me read a few of these. Virtue is not simply obedience to a set of rules. Right actions done for the wrong reason do not help to build the internal quality or character called a virtue. And it is this quality of character that really matters. You also say, this is actually what I brought listeners connect back to, the quote that I read in the very beginning. For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem of human life was to conform the soul to objective reality. And the solution was wisdom, self-discipline, and virtue. For the modern, the cardinal problem is how to conform reality to the wishes of man. And the solution is technique. There's other quotes, but honestly, I'll leave it at those two. But both of those are just money. That second one too, of conforming ourselves to reality versus trying to conform reality to our desires and wishes. That's just incredible.
Well, that's what we really want to do, isn't it? We want to change the world so that it makes it comfortable for us. And when I say change the world, I'm not even talking about the big picture world. I'm just talking about my own little world that I live in, my day-to-day life. It's like my natural tendency is wanting to conform that world to my pleasure, to my desire, with me at the center of it. And that doesn't get me anywhere. Mm-hmm. But God wants to actually shape me, to change me, he wants to make me something more than I am. You know, there's a lot of talk about values in our world. You know, you got to have the right values. And there's nothing wrong with having the right values, but you can be a pretty unpleasant person who's full of themselves and hypocritical and still hold to great values. We probably think of people who fit that, you know, description. Values are not enough. We want virtues. Virtues are the fruit of the Spirit, that which changes us from within, that which transforms us, that which makes us new. I can't help but keep coming back to it because I think this is a theme in Lewis that oftentimes kind of gets overlooked by some people. And it's such a key theme that Lewis is all about transformation. I mean, so many wonderful word pictures and stories within the Chronicles of Narnia are even about that. Think of Edmund being undragoned. You know, the painful process that he has to go through to be actually made into who God wants him to be, who Aslan in that case wants him to be.
That's my favorite scene, by the way. I just did a conversation with some Narnia individuals, and the Eustace undragoning is like, I love that. Love it.
Yeah. And I say Edward is Eustace. Thank you. Yeah, you're right.
Listeners, because I talk about it so much, I was not worried about them knowing what you meant there. I mean, I think of too, when you talk about the transformation, you kind of joked about how it's a cliche to have a book change your life, but, you know, Mere Christianity did for me too. It was particularly his part on the divine life and how Christianity is not just about, like, it's not just about the forgiveness of sins. That's great, but it's about a full transformation that happens on the inside. And like, the good news is not just, oh, I sinned and now they're forgiven. That's wonderful. That's a really great start. We need that. But it's like, the good news is we get to become and partake in this divine life. And there's something so beautiful about that. And that's like just such a powerful message. And I never thought about that, to be honest, until I read Mere Christianity, shockingly, at like 23, 24 years old. I made it that long without really understanding that concept.
That was one of the things that most stuck out to me. I remember his whole idea about, you know, the fact that as we play as children, our play, like we play soldiers and we actually become stronger and learn skills and whatnot, that actually the play is into something more. And mm-hmm. that there is this process of the play in our lives that creates the room for us to become the persons that he wants us to be. One writer, wasn't C.S. Lewis, talked about, you know, if we really want to be changed, our responsibility is, it's like when you pour cement, you have to lay out the forms and then the cement is poured into the forms. And I think that's part of the whole process of sanctification is that, you know, we need to be making good, virtuous decisions to build those forms. But ultimately, it's going to be about God pouring his life into our lives that's actually going to cement real change within us.
That's such a good analogy, because that was my natural proclivity is to, what's the 10-step plan that I need to do? And how do I overcome the vices and add the virtues to my life? And that's not a terrible thought, because like you said, you acknowledge, I mean, doing the virtues, trying to focus on these, this prayer life, this spiritual practice is really helpful for setting some form and structure. I've heard someone once use the term sacred rhythms. You know, we create these rhythms in our life to create space for Christ, but it's just to ultimately let him form within us. So you can't be like, well, I did this, so he loves me more, or I'm earning heaven, or anything like that. It's like this perfect blend of like you're creating this space for him to enter into, for him to transform you. And it really changed my mindset, because it's like, all I can do is invite him in. And there's different ways that looks, but you know, ultimately it's just letting him do the work. And it's honestly quite liberating, because once you try yourself beforehand, oh, it's exhausting. It's like undragoning without his help.
I mean, ultimately, isn't that what grace is about? Yeah. You know, we throw around our theological definition like, grace is unmerited favor. You know, honestly, what does that even mean? And some people in the audience are going to scream, are screaming right now at their computer or their. Well, I'll tell you what that means. I understand what it means. But that definition that you just gave, that's what grace is. Grace is about God working within us to transform us and to make us into little Christs. You know, I mean, probably one of my very favorite things, not probably, it is one of my very favorite things in Lewis is the sermon, The Weight of Glory.
It's a good one.
Yeah. And toward the end of that, where he talks about the fact that, I wish I had the quote right in front of me, but that all the pages of the New Testament are rustling with that promise that someday we will get in. Someday we will become people who can bear that weight of God's glory in our lives. I mean, to me, that is the beauty. That's the beauty of the promise of heaven. It's not that I'm going to finally be able to have every book I've ever wanted, although that would be great if that was heaven. But that, no, I'll be made into the image of Christ, that I'll be exactly what God created me to be one day. And that promise of transformation, once again, runs all the way through Lewis's fiction and nonfiction as our great hope. It's just like, as I said, salvation isn't like I'm moving from one room into a next. No, it's like the whole house is being blown out and I'm in a whole new realm.
For time's sake, let's do one more and I'll let you choose. Actually, I had a couple of them. Which one you like better? I had one on hell and the devil and one on pleasure. Both of those really stuck out to me.
Well, let's talk about pleasure.
I love that. That was the one I was going to choose, to be blunt, because I just think that's not talked about enough today.
Because we've kind of been talking about suffering and how good that is for us. The balance to that is how wonderful pleasure can be for us. Because C.S. Lewis was a champion of experiencing true, full pleasure. If we think pleasure is the work of the devil, we're missing out on seeing the glory of God as the author of all true joy and true pleasure. The problem is that God is not puritanical. He's not just wanting to make sure that we don't overstep the bounds, and he's building all the categories. No, it's bigger than that. I like this. He says, the sins of the flesh are bad, but they are the least bad of all sins. All the worst pleasures are purely spiritual. The pleasure of putting other people in the wrong, of bossing and patronizing and spoiling sport and backbiting, the pleasures of power, of hatred. For there are two things inside me competing with the human self, which I must try to become. They are the animal self and the diabolical self. The diabolical self is the worst of the two. And that's why a cold, self-righteous prig who goes regularly to church may be far nearer to hell than a prostitute.
Ouch. I love that. Well, to piggyback off that too, like to give you a little bit more from that in that section, I brought this one up that I thought was so beautiful because I love that. That's always been one of my favorites since Mere Christianity. Another one, a man who makes his golf or his motor bicycle the center of his life, or a woman who devotes all her thoughts to clothes or bridge or her dog, is being just as intemperate as someone who gets drunk every evening. Of course, it does not show on the outside so easily. Bridge mania or golf mania do not make you fall down in the middle of the road. But God is not deceived by externals. And this comes back to what you and I discussed earlier. It's about the orientation of heart towards Christ and allowing him to transform. So if you're making an idol out of bridge or golf, it's like that's going to prevent you from getting to heaven.
It's going to prevent you from actually getting the greatest pleasures that God has to offer. One last quote here, and we could just read quotes from Lewis all day, but he said, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord Jesus finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition, when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. Wow.
I love finishing that one too. The reason that chapter stuck out to me was, I think today, Satan has successfully done a very good job robbing us of true pleasures. And if you think of Screwtape Letters and you think of, he talks about just reading through news articles and stuff. Nowadays, the infinite scroll of social media, binge watching Netflix, you know, not experiencing the true pleasures of building something, of working towards something, of enjoying friendship and camaraderie, of family life, all the things that were meant to bring us these true pleasures, but instead just doing these cheap dopamine things. I mean, I think Satan's kind of so far won that battle, at least. Hopefully there's a bigger war, obviously, that's being won by Christ. But like, we just don't experience pleasure so much today because of technology, arguably.
We settle for mere happiness.
Yes.
When what Christ offers to us is a stunning kind of joy.
I love that. Well, beautiful. Well, before we wrap up, do you have any projects in the works that you want to tell us about, / any places people can go to learn more about you and your resources?
I've written a number of books that you could learn a little bit more about what I'm thinking about through those, or my website, which I occasionally blog on, not nearly as often as I should, but I've got a good old box on there. And if you want to sign copies of books, you can get them through it. And that's terryglaspie.com. So that's all just my name, terryglaspie.com. You can check that out. I'm really excited about something I'm working on right now. It's a paper that I'm going to deliver at the Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference in September. I'm calling it Jack and Jane.
Ooh.
Why C.S. Lewis Loved Jane Austen. So I'm doing a deep dive into the things, and this gets so much into that whole question of virtue, because a lot of Jane Austen's about what is asking that question about what is true virtue versus what merely looks like virtue. What's just charm? What's something that's charming but empty versus what's actually real and meaningful? So I'm working on that. That's a lot of fun. And then my next book, I think if I continue to I'm continuing to work on it. I think it'll be my next thing out. It will be a book on the connection between our creativity and our spiritual life. Because I kind of want to make the argument that developing and deepening and enriching our spiritual life will feed our creativity, and that our creative life will also feed our spiritual life. That the two are both connected, and that they are both connected to that which is the deepest, most essential part of who each of us is as a unique individual. And so I think God can use both of those as transforming things. So that's something I'm excited about that I'm working on. And it'll probably be a series of talks first before it'll be a book, but it'll be a book eventually.
I love that. I can't wait for that. Well, I hear the call for final drinks. So thank you to our sound engineers, Taylor and Sarah, our intern, Julia, our listeners and our Patreon supporters, particularly our top tier ones, Mary Margaret, Aldo, Alex, James, Matt, Erica, Joelle, Amanda, Thomas, Bud, Shane, Kay, Paul, Gary, Stephen, Kelly, Christian, James, Kate, Peter, David, Angela, and Rowdy. And we want you to know we pray for our listeners in your prayer requests in the Slack channel every Tuesday. And if you enjoyed this episode, please share it on social media. And I want to thank Terry Glaspie for joining this. Terry, thank you so much for coming on this episode. It was just a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me.
I love it. And listeners, please join us next time when we'll continue going further up.
And further in.
Cheers. Cheers.